I think everybody is out of the hospital, to my knowledge, and about the only update thing we need is on our church directories. If you want your name in the church directory, well, I'd be sure and try to get a slip filled out in the next 2 weeks, because we're going to try to have this printed up in the next about the next 3 weeks. Yeah. No. Just ones that have had address changes. Well, if we know if somebody moved away, well, we'll exclude those names. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Coy's. I really enjoyed your responses to our discussion of civil justice last Sunday night in terms of current things that are happening in the United States. I've been, in the past couple weeks, looking at some of the actions of Paul and the reactions of Paul in the book of Acts relative to conflict with magistrates or with crowds that bring the issue to magistrates. And it seems that on his first journey, he suffered a lot of persecution. In one city, he was actually dragged out of the city by a mob of Jews and stoned and left for dead. And his response was that he didn't bring it to the courts or the magistrates. He just got up and went back into the city, it says, which seems kind of strange to me. I would be hightailing it out of there, I think. And then he left the next day, and then a few months later, I guess he went back maybe when the air cleared. On the first journey, he had that kind of treatment sometimes from individuals and peoples, but he didn't seem to run into too much conflict with the magistrates. But on the second journey, he meets with a lot of opposition from duly constituted authorities. And I'm just overwhelmed with how much there is in that, both in the second and third journeys. So if you want to take some notes, we'll be looking at the civil justice, and we are looking at the practice of Paul, not the doctrine so much now, as what he practiced, the practice of Paul, and this, if you want to locate this in his experience, it would be second and third journeys, and then FF, which means forward in time. After the third journey, of course, he's in prison. Now, let me establish some perimeters, okay? Our purpose tonight is not to do expository exegesis. We don't have time for that. Our purpose tonight is to observe and then try to conclude or make some conclusions from the observations of what we see Paul when he has a run-in relative to the magistrates or duly constituted authority. The first one of these that I've chosen is in Philippi. Will you turn to Acts 16? Acts 16, verse 12. It runs from verse 12 through verse 40. That's a lot of verses. We don't need to read them all. But let me point out some things that are really critical to understanding some of his actions at Philippi. Verse 12 reads this way, and notice how specific Luke is. And from thence we came to Philippi, which is the article, chief city of that part of Macedonia. Macedonia is the state or the province. Yeah, thank you. Macedonia is the province. Philippi is the chief city of Macedonia. And then it says, in apposition, King James supplies, and a colony. Now, that word is very important. It is a Roman colony, okay? A Roman colony. Okay, the city itself is a Roman colony. Now, what that means is that the civil administration of Philippi was totally in the hands of Roman citizens. In other words, if a person was a Greek, and for some reason he had not received Roman citizenship, he would not have one chance at being on the city administration of the city of Philippi. Moreover, the constitution of the city was modeled after the Roman constitution or the city of Rome itself, so that a colonial city was like an extension of the city of Rome. Okay? Troas was that way. Antioch of Pisidia was in that category also. And the reason that one way that a city would get this kind of status, which was considered a real honor, a special status, this would be a unique status for a city, and a free city would be a unique status. The way they would get that would be that they had done some special favor for the Roman government, or maybe for the Roman army, or maybe for some division of the Roman army. And in this case, Philippi, when there was civil war, took the side of Augustus and Antony against Brutus and Cassius. And if I remember there, well, I guess the climax for that was in Asia Minor, if I remember correctly. But anyhow, for their part in siding with Augustus and Antony, they were awarded the status of a colony. In this case, it was a military colony. Thessalonica, as we're going to see, became a free city under those same circumstances. Somebody has asked, Luke's description of Philippi is unique. He describes no other city in those terms. And somebody says, why did you think that happened? And Sir William Ramsay says, I think it happened because Luke was from Philippi and he was very proud of the city. Well, I don't think that's the answer. There's another man who has written an excellent book on Roman law in the New Testament, or as it's illustrated in the New Testament. His name is Sherwin White. Excellent book. All of you reading the book of Acts, studying the book of Acts, ought to read that little book. I have a copy, all of you. Obviously, it's in print. But you're welcome to look at my copy if you want. He said, the reason that Luke points out that these unique features of Philippi is that that they are very pertinent to understanding how Paul is going to be treated by the Roman magistrates in that city. And I think that's correct. Okay, it's very important that we understand that from the outset. And we were in that city, the end of verse 12, abiding certain days. And on the Sabbath, we went out of the city by a riverside where prayer was wont to be made, which of course would be by Jewish people or by proselytes to the Jewish faith. And the reason that they did it by the river was that there were not 10 male Jews or 10 male practicing Jews in the city of Philippi. Wherever there were 10 male practicing Jews, that was considered to be enough by the Jews to have a synagogue. There's no synagogue in the city, so they met by the river on the Sabbath. And we sat down and spoke to the women which resorted thither. And a certain woman named Lydia and so on gets saved. Okay? Verse 16. And it came to pass as we went to prayer, a certain damsel possessed with a spirit of divination met us, which brought her masters much gain by soothsaying. The same followed Paul and us and cried, saying, these men are the servants of the Most High God. She mocked them. She kept on doing this. And she was mimicking them and making fools out of them in the sense of she's saying they show us the way of salvation. And this she did many days. And Paul was apparently a patient kind of a soul, and he put up with it for a certain amount of time, but he couldn't stand it any longer. And so after a certain amount, he turned to her and said, I command thee in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her. She was demon-possessed. Notice the expression, and he came out of her, or he came out the same hour. And when the masters saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul, and they were using this woman, you see. They were leading people to her for prophecies, for expressions of divination, for all of this occult business, and they were taking part of the price. And so hey, they had lost a source of income. And when her masters saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul and Silas, and they dragged them into the marketplace before or unto the rulers. Okay? And they brought them to the magistrates. Now we have two words relative to civil authority in the city of Philippi. And the chain of command actually went something like this. The first one is the second word that's used. They brought them to the magistrates. Now that word is really praetors in, well, that would be in Latin. That would be a praetors is not the Greek word. It's a Latinized meaning of the Greek word. The Greek word is strategoi. Okay? And it means praetor. The next level on the chain of command is expressed in verse 19. Rulers. Okay? The people bring them to the rulers, and then they proceed on unto the praetors. Okay? Now the praetors are going to do something else. First the accusation is made before the praetors, saying, these men, verse 20, being Jews, was Silas a Jew? Not sure. But anyhow, they get identified with being Jews, do exceedingly trouble our city, and teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans. And what they are saying is that the charge against Paul is a straw man. It relates to his Jewishness. And they are accused of teaching something that was contrary to anything a Roman could accept. In this case, it's a religious concept, see? Okay? Now, that may have well been true in the sense that that the Romans were pagans, and Paul is probably challenging them with the one true God concept. But the real issue really was that they had lost a source of income. So it's a straw man that they're building, see? Okay, but nevertheless, here's Paul standing before the authorities. Verse 22. And the multitude rose up together against them, and the magistrate, or the strategor, or the praetors, or the duumvirs, Latin, rent off their clothes and commanded to beat them, and the persons that they commanded to beat them, and when they had laid many stripes on them, they are the sergeants of verse 35. So down here are the sergeants. Okay? And then way down here is the jailer. In other words, here's the guys that are going to sort of convict you. Here's the guys that are going to sort of stripe you if you need stripes, or if the conviction carries stripes with it, and here's a guy that's going to see to it that you're safe in jail, or that you're safe in jail, that you're put in jail, or he's watching over you. Okay. The praetors were the supreme magistrates. Okay. Praetors were the supreme magistrates. If you were to look at this in Latin, you might find these men called duovari or duumvir. The rulers were like the council. The sergeants were interesting. The name in Greek is really rabdukois, because that goes along with their title, but they were known in that day, or they could be called lictors. And they were like the police officers. Constables, maybe. Okay? Constables. And they had an insignia. The insignia was a sheath of, I think it was like a sheath of wheat that was bound in the middle and then with an axe sticking up from it. And that was like their badge, their police badge. And everybody knew who they were. And they were the ones who administered whatever the praetors demanded. Okay? And then the jailer, of course, he was just the guy who kept watch over the jail. So remember now, these are all Romans. These are all Romans because this is a Roman colony. They had to be Roman citizens. They may have been of a Greek extraction, or they may have been of some other extraction, but they were citizens of some sort. Now, the thing that's difficult in the story, and I'm sure that you know this, is that Paul and Silas do not make known the fact that they too are Roman citizens. And why they didn't make it known earlier, we're not told in the narrative at all. It's possible that they weren't given a chance to make it known. Or by the time they were given a chance to make it known, they were scourged or something and had already passed, and so Paul chose not to make it known that he was a Roman citizen. And to punish a Roman citizen without due process of law was like taking your life in your own hands. I mean, one thing we can say for the Romans is they did not rule by men, they ruled by law if you were a citizen. And you would not profess to be a citizen under the same punishment of the law, or under a terrible punishment by the law. You would be beaten and you would be fined severely if you claimed to be a citizen and you were not a citizen. Now, does anybody know what the common mark of a citizen was? What was the common mark? How would you recognize a citizen? Well, the common mark of a citizen was the Roman toga, the garb that you wore. But togas were expensive. I mean, you don't wear the best suit to the marketplace. And a toga was a very expensive garment. And apparently Paul did not have a toga on, nor did Silas. They had nothing whereby you'd there was another thing that you could, they had a little they had like an ID thing. It was hinged, it was on wood, and the ID was on the inside. You opened it up, you could carry one of those. But that wasn't too handy to carry either. And apparently there was no identification of their Roman citizenship. And for some reason, they do not make it known at this point that they are Roman citizens. Okay? Question. Well, there were several ways to become a Roman citizen. If you, again, did some type of something of military value, perhaps you were in the military and you did something heroic and you were not a citizen. Or if you were a foreigner in a land like Tarsus where Paul was raised, and perhaps your parents did something of benefit to the Roman army. They would remember that, and their way of remembering that would be, we make you a citizen. It was also possible, under certain conditions, to buy your citizenship. Not under the table, but openly. You could sometimes purchase citizenship. There were three or four ways to become a citizen. And of course, you could be born a citizen. Now, Paul was born a citizen, which means, and he was a Jew of the Jews. Both of his parents were Jews by ethnic identity. But he was born, which means his father somehow was a citizen, or maybe even his grandparents. There were several ways to become a citizen. There are three of them. Okay? Okay. Now, you know the story. The magistrates succumbed to the rulers and the crowd. They yield to that. And they command the sergeants to beat them, and then they're thrown into jail. And then Paul and Silas heist a song at midnight, sing Amazing Grace, and Paul preaches, and the walls cave in, and the jailer gets saved, and his whole family gets saved, and takes them home and feeds them and bathes them and washes his stripes. And so it looked like the whole thing's going to turn out, you know, very positive. Think of Paul telling the testimony, you know, about what happened in Philippi. But the next day, verse 35 says, when it was day, the magistrates, now that's this higher echelon right here, they rethink the thing. They say, let these men go. We really don't have a charge against them. And the keeper of the prison, that's this guy down here, low man on the totem pole, told the saying to Paul, hey, the praetors, or the duumvir, have sent to let you go. Now, will you? You can go. Go in peace. The door's open. And thanks a lot for telling me the gospel. And I'm really a believer, and I really think this was all of the Lord. See you later. Whoops! But Paul said unto them, verse 37, hold it. Now he's going to make it known. They have beaten us openly, uncondemned. There was really no, there was not a charge that could be substantiated, or there wasn't even a charge brought in a legal sense against us. You know, in the normal fashion of leveling a charge against a person, a Roman citizen, the procedure wasn't followed. Oh, I can just see these sergeants going, "You're a citizen? Really? You condemned us being Romans? You have cast us into prison? How do they thrust us out in a secret sort of way?" Oh, no. Truly. Tell the praetors to come down and let them release us. Now, he had to be planning that the whole time. I mean, after the series of things happened, Paul had to be planning this. This wasn't spontaneous. He knew what he was going to say. Okay. So the sergeants then, now time is passing. Paul says, "Well, let's just sit down and be comfortable here in the jail." And the sergeants go across town and they fetch the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. And they came and they besought them. They anxiously besought them and brought them out and desired them to depart out of the city. They made a public apology and pleaded with them that they would go out of the city. And they went out of the prison and entered the house of Lydia, and when they had seen the brethren, those that they had won to the Lord, they comforted the brethren. Not the brethren comforted them. They comforted the brethren and they left. Okay? Okay. Now let's observe now and conclude. Or let's conclude. We are thinking about the actions relative to civil justice. And we're going to observe in the various situations that these change, that they don't follow a pattern all the time. Okay, the first thing that we want to state in terms of observations. The authority of the praetors was proper in the best legal sense. In the best legal sense. They had great authority. When we say in the best legal sense, we mean it was established and backed up by written law. By written law. So that Paul knew that they were governed by law and not by human beings. Okay? Okay. The charge against Paul was a straw man. And he knew that too. it was just something to focus on to get the attention of the authority. And the straw man related. It was a straw man relating to his Jewishness. Did you notice that? See, some Gentiles had gotten mixed up in this, and they said, "These men, being Jews, are teaching us things which we can't go along with, or we cannot observe, because we are Romans and they are Jews." So the focus is on his Jewishness, which by implication says that Christianity was still considered a sect of the Jews. It is not until that changes that you're going to have more severe persecution. Christianity was still seen or viewed as a sect of the Jews. Just some type of addendum on to Jewishness. Because everywhere Paul went, he always went to the synagogues first and sought to reach Jews who were regenerated in Old Testament fashion. Point C. For unexplained reasons, and I'm simply putting this down as an observation, because I do not know why this is, except that perhaps they couldn't express themselves to be Romans. And later on, he's going to express himself. For unexplained reasons, Paul and Silas's citizenship remained hidden. Okay. Now, despite all that, yet Paul, point four, claims his rights under civil law after it's all over with. You must understand that he knew that his Christian mission was somewhat threatened if he could not function with certain civil rights. I think it's interesting that Paul avoids, or appears to avoid at least, geographical areas where he may have gotten in trouble relative to that. In other words, geographical areas that were a little up and down in terms of consistent administration of Roman law. There was a colony, it really wasn't a province, but there was an area east of Tarsus like that. And he seems to avoid that area in many ways in terms of his mission. But he knew that he was going to be involved with many of the key Roman cities. And if he could not function under law in those cities, his mission was severely restrained. So his Christian mission is in view, you see? And this is one of the reasons that he claims his rights under civil law. And he's asking the Roman authorities, just enforce the law you have, and I'm out of trouble. I'm not in trouble. Okay? Okay. In other words, he wasn't passive about it. He didn't say, well, this is a matter I'll leave in the hands of the sovereignty of God, not say a word about it. No, he didn't do that. He actively pursued what was rightfully his. In the next town, he's not going to be able to do that. His hands are going to be tied. So we draw a conclusion, okay? The fifth point, point E. This is a conclusion. Though governments may unlawfully exercise satanic opposition, or maybe the opposition will be legal opposition. Maybe the government would make a law relative to the situation. In this case, that was not the issue. Though governments may unlawfully exercise satanic opposition, the believer's hope for peaceful existence in the world is in proper exercise of government under law. In other words, when government ruling by law breaks down so that you have anarchy, then your functioning as a Christian in terms of expression and so on is severely threatened. Paul is going to consistently appeal to that principle and sort of place himself in the hands of that principle, even though the government in no way professes any type of identity toward Christianity. At this point in history, they had not been against, they had not been for. They didn't even know anything about it. They just saw it as a sect of the Jews. Okay? Okay, now all those observations I think are kind of obvious. And I, maybe even before I've even communicated this, I don't remember. But one of the keys to understanding what happened to in that city is that was a Roman colony. And Luke makes sure that we understand that when we open up the paragraph. Now, any questions on what we said so far about that colony? Okay, let's go on to the next one, and the whole situation is going to change. The next one is at Thessalonica. Thessalonica, the modern Salonica, chapter 17, verses 1 through 9. Okay, just keep reading right on. Now when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Now the thing that we have to point out about Thessalonica, in contradistinction to Philippi, is that this was a free city. A free city. Known in Roman times as an urba libera. An urban libera. Syrian Antioch was this way. Tarsus was this way. Athens was this way. What does that mean? That means that that city is self-governed in all of its internal affairs. It is not looked upon as an extension of the city of Rome. It is not a Roman colony, as was Philippi. The local magistrates, in many cases, had the power over the life and death of its citizens. In other words, the magistrates could rule for capital punishment within their own jurisdiction, and they were not much limited in that. Moreover, even though Thessalonica is located in the larger province of Macedonia, the Macedonian government, or governor, does not have jurisdiction over that city. It is a free city. And in that city, the city rulers were known as politarchs. Politarchs. These are the city rulers. And there was always more than one in order to keep the balance of power so that one couldn't have too much power. Okay? Now, watch what happens. Verse 2, and Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scriptures. And here's what he was trying to prove, that Messiah must needs have suffered when he came, and that he would die, and that he would be raised again from the dead. And I am going to tell you about the fact that this Jesus, that is Jesus of Nazareth, whom I'm telling you about, he is the Messiah. Okay? So, response was, verse 4, some of them believed, and they consorted with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, that is, Greeks who had proselytized to the morality and the ethic of Jewish monotheism, a great multitude, and of the chief women, not a few, some of the leading women in the community. So, he had some relative success. But, again, he is now going to be pursued by Jews who were hostile to the gospel. But the Jews which believed not, moved with envy, took unto them certain lewd fellows, King James says. The word is really poneros, which means actively evil. We had the word kakas this morning. The love of money is a root of every kakas, which is evil often on the basis of human weakness. But poneros is active evil, aggressive evil, not based on weakness, but the desire actually to destroy or to do something evil. That's the kind of people they look for. They took unto themselves actively evil men of the baser sort. Now, that meant they were rabble-rousers. And they gathered a company, and they set all the city on an uproar. The word baser sort, which means rabble-rouser or rabble-loafer, really, is the idea of like an aggressive hippie who was able to arouse a crowd, and that's exactly what they did. And apparently they couldn't find Paul and Silas, so they assaulted the house of Jason, who apparently was Paul's host, and they sought to bring them out to the people. Now, there's a question about the word people. It's not the regular word for people. It's a word demos. And demos could mean a council, a group that operated or functioned as a council in the city. It's possible that they gathered those together, but it also could mean a mob, so it's questionable about what it means. Anyhow, when they found them out, they dragged Jason and certain brothers to the politarchs. That's this word right here, see? To the city rulers. And said, these are they which have turned the world upside down. They have come hither also. whom Jason hath received. That's kind of indicative that Paul and Silas were, and Luke may have been there. No, let's see. Luke may have left them at Philippi. Well, anyhow, Paul and Silas were there, and they couldn't find him. So he said, "They do." Here's the charge now. "These all do contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, one Jesus." Now that is a charge of sedition. It is the idea that they are saying to the rulers of the city, these men are seditious, they are revolutionaries, they are encouraging people to devote themselves to Jesus as king and divorce themselves to Caesar as king. There's just a little bit of truth in that, but it's not the whole story, see? So they're successful. They trouble the people. And that's a different word for people than the word that is used in verse 5. This is the crowd now. "And they troubled the crowd and the politarchs of the city when they heard these things." So what did they do? They took, verse 9, security, and the word means surety. They made him a hostage. They took hostage of Jason and of the others, and they let them go. So they have a hostage. And you want to remember that this is a free city, which means that it is totally controlled inwardly, and that in many cases they could take life. They could actually have capital punishment. So Paul is in a totally different situation. He cannot use his Roman citizenship. Of course, he's not the one that's captive. So he opts to leave the city. Verse 10. "And the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea." And then we're told what happens there. In other words, Paul felt that he had no legal recourse. Why? Totally different situation than you find in Philippi. Okay? Alright, let's record some observations. First of all, sometimes lawfully constituted government may silence Christian leaders. Now, we're not told anything that happened to the other Christians in the city. It was Paul and Silas that they apparently were after. See? And they wanted to get Paul and Silas out of town. We do know that that later on, the Christians are severely persecuted in this town. But and Thessalonica becomes a real dynamic, energetic church. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians that they were a witness to the whole world, despite all the persecution that they had. So, hey, yeah, we do know that the persecution turned on them, didn't it? We just don't have a lot of detail about it. Okay, in this case, this lawfully constituted government, even though it had an inadequate charge or a charge that wasn't substantiated before the courts, they were able to silence the leaders. Okay? Point two. Apparently, Paul had no legal recourse. Now, what is another possibility? What's another possibility? Or he chose not to use his legal recourse. In other words, he might have felt that it would just be endless frustration to use what legal recourse he had. Okay? At least he does that. He chose not to use it if he had it. For whatever reason. Maybe crooked government. Maybe he felt that there was too much pressure in the city that he wouldn't have a fair trial. Whatever. Okay? Okay. We can also see from this that independent local government may be more oppressive, and usually is. It may be more oppressive than the federal government. Okay. Now, in 1 Thessalonians, Paul makes a reference that most likely applies to this. Here's what happens. Paul goes on to Berea. If you look down at verse 13, and the Jews from Thessalonica follow him. But when the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God was preached of Paul in Berea, they came thither also and stirred up the people. And they immediately, the brethren sent Paul as to go, as it were, by sea, but Silas and Timotheus abode there still. And they conducted Paul, brought him to Athens. So Paul goes to Athens alone. He leaves Silas and Timothy at Berea, and then he sends Timothy back to Thessalonica to stay there and strengthen those believers. And Timothy stays there probably for a whole year, which means that really the ones that they were after were probably Paul and Silas. And Timothy is able to go back. Now, will you look at 1 Thessalonians 2:18, where there is an expression of Paul about his desire to go back, but his hands were tied, he felt, or at least he felt it would be unwise to go back, and look at the way he expresses it. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 18. I'll read verse 17. But we, brethren, being taken from you for a short time in presence, but not in heart, endeavored the more abundantly to see your face with great desire. This is about 1 year from that experience we read on in Acts. Wherefore, we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, many times, once and again. I would be glad to have come to you, but Satan hindered us. You see that? Satan hindered us from returning. Now that is a theological interpretation of the clever action of the Polytarchs of Thessalonica. Because what the Polytarchs apparently had done was held Jason accountable if the Apostle Paul came back to the city, and most likely under the threat of taking his life. And so Paul says, hey, it isn't worth it. I'm not coming back, but I want you to know I really wanted to come back. And he interprets the whole action theologically by saying, this can only be satanic right out of the pit. Understand? Okay, any questions about his actions at Thessalonica, which are a lot different than what happened at Philippi? Okay, let's go on to the third one. The whole end of the book of Acts from chapter 16 on is full of this. Just one action right after another that's recorded. There were many other things that Paul was doing, but the things that the Holy Spirit leads Luke to choose to record have some type of run-in with civil magistrates in every case from chapter 16 to the end of the book. Okay? The third one is at Corinth. Okay? And again, the nature of this is totally different. Okay, here he comes to Corinth, chapter 18. And after these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth. And he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, and his wife Priscilla. And the reason they had come from Italy is because Claudius had commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. All right, now there's a lot that's said in there. Aquila is a Roman name, which probably means that this man who was really a Jew was a Roman citizen. We don't know for sure, but probably. But moreover, he was a born-again believer. But he doesn't divorce himself from his Jewishness. He is still not only identified as a Jew. When Claudius says, all Jews get out of Rome, He doesn't say, well, I'm a Christian now and I don't have to leave because I really believe that the Messiah has come and let me tell you what this means, blah, blah. He didn't do that. He just left. Which means that Christianity was still being looked upon as some sect of the Jews by many, many people. Okay? So he chooses to leave. And because they're both of the same craft, they were leather workers, they lived together. And so the normal procedure in ancient times was the work day started about 5 o'clock in the morning. And by 11 or 12 or by 11:30, the work day was done. Our work day normally starts around 8. And after, you know, 6 cups of coffee, people start working about 9:30. Well, our work day starts, 9 to 5, 8 to 4:30, whatever. With theirs, wasn't that way. Their work day started very early, ended around noontime. So Paul would reason in the synagogue every Sabbath, and usually in the marketplace in between. He reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And when Silas and Timothy were come from Macedonia, there they're coming back from that where he left them, Timothy at Philippi, Silas at Berea, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. And the implication is very strong movement, constrained to give public testimony. And when they opposed themselves and blasphemed, he shook his raiment and said to them, okay, your blood be upon your heads, I'm clean, I'm going to the Gentiles. And he departed thence and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one who's worshipped God, and whose house was hard joined to the synagogue. Now this is probably Titus Justus, and maybe the Titus that we read about so much. Okay, now that's one thing. But here he is preaching in the synagogue, and eventually there comes a break. They say, hey, we don't believe what you're saying. Get out of here. So a guy right next door is a believer. He's become a believer. He says, yeah, come on, move in with me. Now that's one thing. Okay? Then the next verse says, and Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. It's one thing to have the guy right next door to the synagogue, but then to win the leader of the synagogue, to win the pastor, so to speak. I mean, that's more than they can stand. So the Lord speaks to Paul and encourages him to stay there. And he stays about a year and 6 months. And something happens because a new proconsul is named, verse 12. And when Gallio was made deputy, and the word really means proconsul, of Achaia, which is what we call Greece, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul and brought him to the Bema. Okay? Okay. So he's at Corinth. And Corinth is part of a Roman senatorial province. Okay? Now there were two kind of provinces. There were imperial provinces and there were senatorial provinces. And I don't remember at this time. Probably maybe 24, 26 provinces. And if you were the head of a province, well then you collected a lot of taxes from the province. In this case, since it's a senatorial province, the governor or the proconsul, okay, proconsul, which the King James translates deputy, this man is, this is the name of a governor of a senatorial province. It's a technical name for him. Okay? Okay. Proconsuls often held court. That is, under Roman law, private persons could bring an accused person with charges against them to the tribunal. And often the proconsul could sit as the judge of the tribunal. This was under Roman law. And he had the liberty, or any judge who sat in that condition, had the liberty to either to hear the case, to make further inquiry into the case, to investigate the case, or he could refuse to hear the case at all. Now, Gallio, apparently, he was very shortly there as proconsul. And so apparently the Jews who had had this problem with Paul decided to drag him to Gallio to sort of test the mettle of Gallio. So it says, and when Gallio was or became the proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul and brought him to the Bema, the judgment seat, the tribunal. And here was their charge. This fellow persuaded men to worship God contrary to the law. And they are referring to Jewish law, not to Roman law. So first of all, in observations, I want you to note that the charge was ambiguous from a Roman point of view. The charge was ambiguous from a Roman point of view. And I want to spell that out for you, okay? Okay. Under Roman point of view, there could be something like this. First, status quo religion. Status quo religion would be religio socio, the religion of the society, in which this case it would be state paganism. And on the state payroll were all the pagan priests and soothsayers and occultists and so on. And that was the state religion. And that was religion socio. Secondly, there could be legalized religions. These religions would not necessarily fit into the state socio system, but they had been officially recognized by the Roman government and were considered to be religio licita, licensed religions, as per Judaism. It was a common practice anywhere in the Roman state or the Roman empire to allow the Jews great liberty. They were looked upon as a legalized religion and not to interfere. And they were given great liberty in the management of their own social practices. There was a restriction in Palestine that they were not to take life. They were not allowed to do that. They had to take the person to court for that. Well, then there would be the potentiality of illegal religions. Okay? Now, this is the charge. See? This is this charge that is brought against these people. Only it's brought in relationship to Jewish law. The charge is, hey, the Christianity that Paul is preaching is illegal according to our law. And it didn't relate from a Roman point of view. So, Paul is about to open his mouth to make his defense, and he doesn't even get the words out. Verse 14. And when Paul was now about to open his mouth, Gallio said unto the Jews, hey, if it were a matter of wrongness, or, and the word really means crime, or wicked lewdness or villainy, O you Jews, reason would that I would really bear with you. I would really hear you out if you had some objective crime or some villainy that you were going to present to me. But if it be a question of word, not words, and names, and then it says, not your law, but law according to you. We don't go by law according to you. We go by law according to the Roman state. But if it were law according to you, look you to it. For I will, and the verb is boulomai, which means I have made my determination, I will be no judge in such matters. And he drave them out of the judgment seat, which is a way of saying he threw the case out of court. Okay? Now, when he threw that case out of court, as a representative of the imperium, the imperial Roman government, he set a precedent. See? Gallio, in effect, ruled for freedom of expression. And that was a momentous thing for Paul and Christian leaders, at least in face of the charge that was laid against him. There was nothing he had against them. He had no objective crime. He had no villainy, even no sense of a scheme that they could bring against him. And in a very real sense, he set a precedent. Okay? Okay. That precedent, because of the authority that is speaking now, this is not some local magistrate. This is not some, like, Polytarch from Thessalonica that's been elected by the citizen. This man has been sent by the Roman Senate to govern the colony of Achaia, which we call Greece today, which we call southern Greece today, and he makes a decision, and the decision is, we cannot bind this man's hands. He hasn't done anything. And that sets a legal precedent. Okay? So point C. This verdict from the imperial government set a precedent. And Paul relied on it. You understand? In other words, what I'm saying is, think if he would have ruled negatively against Paul, if Gallio had done that, and maybe Paul would have beaten and been fined and set free or whatever and told to get out of here, then how would that have affected his plans? Where would he have gone? Where could he go from there where it wouldn't happen again because a precedent had been set? But it's just the opposite that happened. The senatorial government supported Paul instead of silencing him. And it is a form of a precedent for freedom of Christian expression. So again, we have some form of identity, involvement with civil law, and we have a response to it. Now, Paul isn't going to stay there long. You'll notice in the next statement it says, then the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue. He was the successor in the synagogue to Crispus, and they beat him before the judgment seat, and that is just indicative of the anti-Semitism of the Greeks of that time, and Gallio didn't pay any attention to it. And by the way, it may be that Paul or Luke mentions that because there is a Sosthenes that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 1:1 that gets saved. And it may be that he mentions that just in view of the fact that, not only did Crispus get saved, but somewhere along, if this is the same Sosthenes, he got saved. Paul tarries there for a while and then he leaves. Okay? Okay, now the next one is too long. Let me just put it down and sort of tell you what happens. The last one, Luke is emphasizing this, see? In the latter part of the book, Paul is going to be arrested. He's going to be arrested in Jewish territory by the Sanhedrin. Okay? That's the initial aspect of his arrest. And in that scenario, he makes an appeal to Roman law. So in these concluding chapters, and you'll notice that's a large section, that's seven chapters of the book of Acts. Paul finds himself in the Roman judicial system. And he not only finds himself in it, he appeals to it. Okay? And the charges against him are all spurious. They are all wrong. And yet, he chooses to fight them through civil law, not through revolution, not through rebellion, not through anarchy, not by having someone hide him. He chooses to fight them under the Roman system. Okay, this section records Paul's arrest and imprisonment, in which he appeals to the system that Alamy is going to take him to Rome. Now, if space is a criteria of importance of subject matter, then Luke sees this as the most important part of the book because he devotes more time to this than he does any single section or incident in the whole book. It is very possible that Luke was seeking to demonstrate the relationship of the church to the state in the time of Paul. Okay, now let me simply give you some points. Okay, observations on this section. And I'll have to sort of dictate them. One, he expected the objective justice from Rome that the Jewish hierarchy would not give him. In other words, he is arrested by the Jewish hierarchy and he appeals for a hearing, but he doesn't get justice under the Jewish hierarchy. So his only other recourse was to appeal to a higher source, and he chooses to appeal to the Roman law. Of course, he had that in the back of his mind all the time. His final appeal to Rome, of course, comes in Acts, and he's sort of leading up to this all along. It comes in Acts 25, 9 and 10. Okay? Then said Paul, he is now appearing before Festus. He's at Caesarea, and he says, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as thou very well knowest, for if I be an offender or committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. If I did something, I commit myself to the law. I trust myself to be rightfully accused and convicted under the law, and I won't refuse to die. But if there be none of these things whereof they accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar. He totally gives himself to the law. So point two, which is part of that same passage, what we're saying is, he boldly declares his respect for not only for the law, but for enforcement of the law. See? Acts 25, verse 11. He not only feels that the law is necessary, he feels that he can rightfully give himself totally to it and come out exonerated. And in so doing, you see, he is endorsing the civil law of a pagan government. Point three. Paul did rely on government to restrain violent and malicious people. He trusted due process of law to protect his civil rights, and he appealed to it. Okay? Fourthly. Last point. Paul appreciated the help of orderly civil government to provide a tranquil atmosphere in which to preach the gospel. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2. This is where the doctrine comes after, but the practice, you see, we see in the book of Acts. And the book of Acts is going to close with him ready to make his final defense before Caesar in Rome. So what are we saying? We are saying essentially this. When you want to look for the doctrine about the believer's attitude to civil government, you look in places like Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 6. You look in Peter chapter 2 about verses, 18 through 23, something like that. But when you want to observe a person practicing and identifying in terms of how he must react when he comes into conflict with the civil authority, you look to the example of Paul in the book of Acts, and the book is just loaded with it. It's fantastic. Reinforces what he believed. Are there any questions I could try to answer? Yeah. Okay. Our last point was Paul appreciated the help of orderly civil government to provide a tranquil atmosphere in which to preach the gospel. Now, you see, he illustrates that in Thessalonica. He could have stayed there and been a thorn in their flesh, but he doesn't. He chooses to move on. And then he makes that direct doctrinal statement in 1 Timothy 2:2, where he tells us, pray for governments, for those, for rulers, for kings, etc., that we may lead a tranquil and peaceable life. And he is saying we are dependent upon national governments for that sort of thing. And he's very willing for that. And not only willing for that, he encourages us to pray for that, even though the government may be a pagan government. Well, I don't know that we've covered all the implications of what's found in those passages, but I find it kind of exhilarating to know that we'd only have a doctrine, we have an example. We can look to it to see perhaps what some of our actions should be relative to government. And I'll tell you one thing. It is a responsibility of Christians to see to it that we are governed by laws, good objective laws, and not by men. And that's what Paul relied in terms of the Roman system. And fortunately, not by a chance, really by the sovereignty of God, that kind of government was in existence over the whole world, around the Mediterranean area, when they began to preach the gospel. It gave the gospel an opportunity to really get rooted and established. Shall we close in prayer? Father, we thank you for the opportunity to examine these passages, and we pray that the practicality of this will not escape us in terms of our responses to a society and government in which we live. We do pray for a continued form of government and peace in this country, that the gospel might be furthered by those of us who are believers. In Christ's name, amen.